It is a pleasure for me to be here, and I should have asked for lapel. I'm the kind of guy that kind of walks around a lot, so I'm kind of stuck here, but we'll see if I can maneuver that. As Dennis was saying, this is something I've been working on, and you might ask, you know, why is an Old Testament prophet Denver doing this? And let me give you a bit of my background and story, and then I'll kind of move into what I'd like to talk about today. I'm half Guatemalan. My mother is Guatemalan, and we were raised bilingual and bicultural in Houston. And I would spend all my summers in Guatemala, and for a number of summers, my parents would put us in school. The Guatemalan school year goes from mid-January to mid-October, so we were in school kind of 24/7. At the time, it wasn't a lot of fun, but looking back, I'm grateful for that. And when people look at me, I'm 6 foot six. And if you know anything about Latin America and Guatemalans are very short. So when I say I'm half Guatemalan, people go, that's not true. But it is, you see. My father was an American. I have an older brother. He's 5 foot six. My father was the son of Irish immigrants. And so my brother turned out very white skinned with freckles, blue eyes, and blondish hair in this little Guatemalan body. And here I am, 6 foot six, brown eyes, different color skin. And I used to have black hair. People don't believe that, but that's also true. So here we are, this genetic mistake. But I was raised this way, and for me it was normal to go back and forth between the countries, and we had Latin friends in Houston. There's a large Cuban population in Houston. My brother actually married a Cuban. And we were just raised with this as a normal kind of thing, and actually after I went to seminary, we went to Latin America, and I taught in Guatemala City for about 15 years before coming back to Denver. And I'm adjunct still in Guatemala City, so I go every year. But one of the things that I noticed when I came back, really for the first time when I came back to the U.S., this would have been late 90s, I began to move into the Hispanic world, which is a different world than what I was used to growing up. And it was this whole immigrant debate. And there was something that I began to see as I moved into this world that disturbed me. And it was this. You see, I would have conversations with Christian friends and acquaintances and colleagues, and the conversations I would have about immigration wouldn't be Christian conversations. Now, they'd be about the economics, they'd be about the healthcare issues, they would be about the schools, Hispanic gangs, and all, you know, they would give me numbers. And oftentimes not well informed, but it would be that kind of secular approach. And this bothered me because I was asking myself, why can't we begin to talk about this as Christians, very self-consciously as Christians? And maybe it would change the tone of the debate. Maybe it would change how we would get at the debate. And this is why I sat down and wrote the book, which is Christians at the Border. So this morning, what I'd like to do, and I hope you can see, that? Does that work? Yes? Just grunt or... Okay, all right. I mean, all the Baptists are in the back. I mean, I noticed that when I came in. But I want to think about a different lens and ask ourselves this. Can the Bible help us on this? And my answer is going to be yes. Now, I won't go into all the historical pieces. In the book, I do some of that. But what you learn is that this is not any kind of new issue. Immigration has been a debate in this country since the founding of the Republic. This is a cartoon, actually, from the 1890s in Harper Magazine. And what you see is Uncle Sam here at the gate. And it says, United States of America, you know, welcome. And he's holding his nose. And here is this immigrant. Back then, this would have been maybe a European immigrant from southern Europe, the Italians, for instance. And this immigrant, you can tell it's 19th century. On his back, he has this barrel that says Sabbath desecration. See, this is what the immigrants were bringing. Another thing here says poverty, and this one says disease. You see, this is what the immigrants were bringing. So this reaction against newcomers is nothing new. Now here's don't know if you can see that one. Have you ever seen this one? This is where they have the pick, and they're like Iowa farmers. Have you seen this one? This is the theory that some have is once the horde, you know, and the invasion, you know, has its high point, we have the sombreros, and instead of the pitchfork, you'll have a Mexican guitar. I mean, so that would be the fear. And this here is the Statue of Liberty, and this is the Christ that overlooks the harbor at Rio de Janeiro in Brazil. These are the kinds of fears. These are the kinds of sentiments. And in Texas, of course, this would be huge. Denver is about 35% Hispanic. Now, when we begin to talk about this as Christians, the thing that we need to ask ourselves, this is a picture of the border, is this where we want to begin the conversation? You see, because sometimes when I have a conversation with Christians about immigration, the first place they take me is Romans 13. You see, they've broken the law, I mean, Romans 13, and so, you know, what is it about illegal you don't understand kind of argument? Well, I don't know if this is the best place to begin the conversation, because if you start to talk here, it ends any kind of dialogue. It shuts it down, and it reduces everything to issues of legality and illegality, who's in, who's out, full stop, we're done. And what I would suggest to you is that maybe we need a different starting place as Christians. Now, we need to get to the border, we need to get to Romans 13, but I would say that's not the place to start, that may be the place to end the discussion. So where would I start it? Well, I would start it in Genesis 1 and 2. I would begin at the beginning. Because here it says that every human being is made in the image of God, male and female. Now, you all are seminary students, and you have profound studies in these kinds of things. And you would know there's different theories and ideas about what the image of God entails. For some, it's what we have and who we are. You see, we have a mind, and we have emotions and will, and we have this kind of spiritual side to us, a soul. And these are the things that make us different from the animals, and these are the things that make us unique. These are the things that give us ultimate value in the sight of God. And that's true. See, every human being does have worth. And if we're going to talk about immigration, what we need to begin to think about is immigrants as people. Let's begin there. There's another way of looking at the image of God, and if you've done some Old Testament study, you would know this too. Because when he says, you know, let us make them in the image, he says, and let them rule and subdue the earth. Now, what this tells you then is that every human being has potential. Every human being has the capacity to do wondrous things, to rule the earth. Now, if you take this and add this into debate, this also will kind of change how you look at immigrants, because now it is not only that they have worth, versus being kind of a faceless mass of lawbreakers, which is how the media sometimes will present it. But what you begin to see is that with their potential, they have an immense capacity to contribute to the common good. The question now becomes, how can we facilitate what they can bring to the country? It's a different kind of question now, isn't it? You see, if you begin somewhere else, this is the key. The kinds of laws that you will elaborate for immigration and the tone of the laws will change. That's why the beginning point is so important. Let us look at them as people and let us think about what they can bring to the country, which is what immigrants have been doing now for 250 years. Every single person in this room is not from here if you go far enough back. I'm the son of immigrants, or one immigrant. My father would be one removed. It's either your parents or your grandparents or your great-grandparents. Everyone in this room is from somewhere else. And see what we can do for the country. Now let's go to some other things, and let's begin to think of the Old Testament. The Old Testament's full of stories like this. This is where I want to start moving around. I've got kind of stuck in this space here. But anyway, the patriarchs. Let's think of this one. How about Abram? You see, Abram will leave Ur of the Chaldees and go up to Haran, and then eventually he'll make his way south. His whole life is the life of a migrant. And the only property he will own is the property he buys to bury his wife. See, the father of the faith is a migrant. Now, it's interesting to see what he does and process it as an immigrant story. You know, in Genesis 12, once he's in the promised land, there's famine, and so he'll move to Egypt. And you know, this is very much the pattern in the ancient world. Egypt, you've got the Nile, so there's water, so they're kind of the breadbasket. And so you have all these people, you know, periodically going to Egypt looking for food. And so there is Abram. And he gets to the border. And he says, well, you know, this isn't my wife, it's my sister. And I remember when I was in seminary, we tried to explain it so that he wouldn't look so bad, you know. I mean, he is the father of the faith, you know. But he's lying or giving a half-truth to get across the border, isn't he? See, his family's hungry. And as a patriarch, he has extended clan, workers, animals, and they need food. And he needs to get across. And he even puts her at risk, you see. But you do what you got to do to feed your family. You ever thought about it that way? It's interesting, isn't it? Here's another one. It's Joseph. Now, Joseph didn't want to go to Egypt. But as you know, the story, he gets sold by his brothers and eventually will be in Potiphar's house. And he's working really hard. I mean, this is how we know immigrants. They work really hard. And he works his way up and he becomes, you know, Potiphar's right-hand man, and Potiphar has to go off on a trip, and Potiphar's wife tries to seduce him. And of course, when push comes to shove, who are they going to believe, the immigrant or the wife? Well, he's the one that goes to jail. But he'll, you know the story, he makes his way out, and then his brothers come. You see, Jacob will send his brothers for food. Again, it's the issue of food, feeding your family. And they come before Joseph, and they don't recognize him. And I remember when I was kind of a new Christian and learning all this, I would ask myself, well, how can they not recognize the brother? Well, you know, many years have passed, and people change, you know. And I go to myself, well, golly, I mean, my brother's 5'6". I'd recognize him, I mean, no matter how many years had gone by. But if you understand the Egyptian background, that far up in the national hierarchy, he would have shaved his head and his face, and he would have makeup on. You've seen pictures of this probably. And he would have some kind of headdress to represent his status. And when he meets his brothers, he uses the ruse of using an interpreter, even though he understands what they're saying. And when they leave, he goes into the back and he weeps. Now let's unpack that. See, they don't recognize him. Why? Because he's assimilated so much. He's married an Egyptian woman. He has Egyptian children. He's second in command of all of Egypt. And here is this immigrant. He's going to save the whole nation from famine. But they don't recognize their brother because he's all painted up and all this kind of stuff. But you see, this immigrant never forgot his mother tongue. And he knows what they're saying. See, deep down, he's still an Israelite. And when I die, take my bones back. You hear the immigrant echo of being bilingual? Así somos algunos. Somos bilingües. Podemos hablar en español o inglés como ustedes quieran. I can speak either language. You never forget the language of the heart. Interesting story, isn't it? How about this one? Ruth. That's interesting because you see, you know, again, you know all these. I mean, you're at seminary, you know all these things. Naomi and her husband will cross the Jordan, go the other side of the Dead Sea into Moab because there's hunger in Bethlehem. And what happens is as they move into Moab, Ruth and another Moabitess will marry immigrants, Naomi's sons. But then Naomi's husband dies, as do the two sons. And so what happens then is Naomi says, look, I'm going to go back home. That makes sense as an immigrant. She's lost her sons and her husband, and she just wants to go home. Then she's learned that there's food, you know, back home, and so it's probably a good time. And Ruth says, look, I'll go with you, and your God will be my God, and your people my people, and I'll go. But if you read chapter 1, Naomi doesn't even acknowledge that. She doesn't even answer Ruth when she says that. A bit odd. Does she believe her? Does she not trust her? Does she not want her? Why doesn't she just say something like, thank you? And then at the end of chapter 1, when they get back to Bethlehem and the women of the town come out to greet Naomi, Ruth isn't even mentioned. Naomi never introduces her. You see, Ruth is just part of the baggage. And you can walk your way through the book of Ruth, and what you're watching is an immigrant trying to become part of the community. At chapter 2, she says to Naomi, let me go work the fields. She knows the Old Testament law, and she knows as a widow she can glean in the corners of the field. And then Boaz comes in the middle of chapter 2. He says, well, who's that woman? Oh, she's the Moabitess. And she's been working all day. In fact, she hasn't taken a break. You see, how do they identify her? Her hard work. They don't know her name, but man, she works hard. And if you know immigrants, this is so much of an immigrant story. I'll skip some of the other details in the story, but this is what you're seeing. And then in chapter 4, the women of the town, the ones who had not even acknowledged her in chapter 1, by the time you get to chapter 4, you know, everyone is impressed by this Moabitess. And then they say to Naomi, you know, she loves you more than seven sons. And Naomi says nothing. Then they hand her the child, and Naomi takes the child. Maybe this was the gesture of finally really accepting her. Now, the son that was born, I'm sure he didn't have to go through the things his mother had gone through as the first generation immigrant. She had to fight those battles herself. And the book of Ruth ends with the genealogy of David. And what you see is this story of this immigrant, no-name woman is part of a larger story that affects the history of Scripture and the history of humankind. How many small stories affect bigger stories? Here's some other ones. Daniel, that's an interesting one. Daniel chapter 1. You know the story. Jerusalem will fall pretty soon. Daniel is taken with his friends. And they begin to educate them. They teach them all the knowledge of Babylon and the language of Babylon. And these are sharp, sharp young men. And they're the best of the class. And they also change their names. This is part of how you express sovereignty in the ancient world. You change somebody's name. That means I own you, basically. You see, you're not going to be Jose anymore. You're going to be Joe, okay? So let's just keep that straight. And then they say, okay, but let us keep our food. Now, that's interesting because what is one of the primary markers for a culture? The food. You know, in Denver, I don't know Waco, but in Denver, you can go down Federal Boulevard, and once you start seeing the pupuserias and the carnicerias and the taquerias, you know you're in the Mexican part of town. And then there's this little bit of a pocket of Vietnamese and all these Vietnamese signs, and then boom, you're back into the Hispanic section.
It's the food.
Now, this is an interesting thing because I'm a half and half. I'm a half breed. So, but for Christmas, we would do it in Guatemalan style. So, what do you have for Christmas? Well,
black beans and tacos and tamales. That's Christmas fare.
And you eat it Christmas Eve, Noche Buena, and you open the presents, Noche Buena.
But then I married this American, you see, from the suburbs of Houston.
Well, you know, Christmas is like turkey and ham, and so we had to kind of negotiate this, you see. So now we've come to a nice agreement. So Christmas Eve, it's the tacos and the rice and the beans and the tamales and one present. And then Christmas morning, it's all the other presents and then the turkey and the ham. So it's great being this bicultural marriage. Not good for the waistline, but it's good for food. I take students every year of the year from Denver to Guatemala. And I tell them, look, you better like black beans. I mean, you know, black beans is like breakfast and lunch and dinner. Did you ever see the movie Forrest Gump? And there's this one scene about the shrimp. Remember that scene? Shrimp gumbo, shrimp salad. Well, I tell my students, it's going to be kind of like that, you know? It's going to be, you know, frijol volteado, where they fry it and they mix it up and it gets hard and you slice it, you know, like meatloaf. And you put some dried white cheese and some salsa picante para chupar sus dedos. You can have it paral, you can have it in soup, you can have it all kinds of ways. Just get ready. Well, you know, Dr. Carroll, I've been to Chipotle, I can do this. Okay. What about after 2 or 3 days, it's, you know, Dr. Carroll, you know, for the sake of God and the kingdom, can we go to McDonald's, please? American food, please. And I say, well, yes, we can. It'll taste a little bit different, but they have the golden arches, and I know that's a sign of the kingdom. And so we can go by, and we'll actually have, I do this. I don't tell them on the front end, but it's always fun to watch. I tell them, look, we'll have pizza night and a movie. And I bring videos, DVDs.
Pizza and a DVD. Oh, Dr. Carroll's great.
Right outside the seminary walls in Guatemala City, there's a Domino's walk-in. What I don't tell them is, in Guatemala, Domino's has black bean pizza. See, it's the food. You ever thought of Daniel's an immigrant story? We could talk about Ezra, Nehemiah, and Esther. Different kinds of responses. Ezra wants to go back. He doesn't want to stay where he is, and he'll go back and reestablish, you know, the land. And Nehemiah, that's an interesting story. Nehemiah will go back for a while. Of course, he's the cupbearer to the king, last line of chapter 1. Now, that's a funny thing, because in the ancient world, if you're a king, you're always worried about assassination, so you have bodyguards, and then you have cupbearers and food tasters, because the other way they can kind of get you is by poisoning you. And so you know that the king, I mean, every meal, he's just watching that guy's face. You okay, buddy? I mean, you know. And you go into chapter 2, and it's funny because it says, and the king saw that my face was sad. The king goes, are we all right here, buddy? I mean, you know, we don't like sad faces around the table here, do we? And he'll go back for a while, then he'll move back to serve the Persian king. And he's generations removed from the land, but he's still getting reports back. Esther, you know, doesn't even think about going back, doesn't even think about her people until Mordecai reminds her. And she ends up saving her people. Old Testament law. I need to move quickly here. The nature of law. Now, this is sometimes how Christians will do this. You know, law is sacrifice for sin. Jesus paid for sin. Therefore, no more law. Law bad. That's kind of the logic. Well, if you believe that, you don't understand Old Testament law. Because it is much more than talking about sacrifice for sin. In fact, there are sacrifices that have nothing to do with sin at all. They're thanksgiving and celebration offerings. The law has to do with whom you marry and whom you don't marry and what you eat. You see, that's a cultural marker. How you raise your kids, how you work your farm, how you treat your animals, who can be king and who can be a judge. You see, what the law is doing is establishing a culture, part of which is the religion. Now, we do this all the time. I mean, you know, in this country, we have laws for the same things that they're dealing with. I mean, you go to the law, there's stuff about, well, I've already mentioned, but about what you do with thieves and what you do with dead people and what you do with property and all these kinds of things that we all have laws about. And a lot of it's pretty arbitrary. That's how you do culture. And in this culture, for instance, you know, we drive on the right-hand side of the road. Well, who decided that? I don't know. And who decided, you know, green means go and red means stop? I don't know. And so who came up with these funny-looking signs, you know, that mean certain things? I don't know. But if you don't get it right, man, you get a ticket. And then you go to Britain, of course, it's all on the other side of the road. Well, who decided that? I don't know. And you've got to learn how to drive on the other side of the road. And they have this whole system, and if you don't do it, man, you get a ticket. And it's funny, you go to London, around, Parliament and all these kinds of things, and they're trying, you know, to control the movement of tourists. But one of the things they do, see, if you're in Britain and you cross the road, you look to your right because that's where the traffic's coming. But if you're an American, you look to your left, because that's where the traffic would be coming. So you have Americans going to London, they go walk right into the traffic. And so they'll have signs at the crosswalks, you know, look right. Underneath this idea, dumb Americans kind of thing. But you see, we organize our laws to frame this culture. And here's the point, besides all of that. I mean, I can tell you, I have all kinds of stories. I have this clock ticking here. But even the traffic things, I'll tell one story, I gotta go. You know, in Latin America, you know, red means to slow down, you know. And you may have lines in the road, but hey, if we can fit some more in here, that's kind of efficient use of space. And, you know, I have, when I come out of the seminary at night, if I've been teaching, there's a light. And sometimes I'm sitting there at 10 o'clock at night and there's nobody coming. And a little Guatemalan voice in me is going, vamonos. And the little American voice is going, they have cameras everywhere. American voice always wins on that one. But you see, when you think about law, it's not only the existence of law, it's the character of law. How does a legal system treat the most vulnerable people in its midst? That is a reflection of its core values. And when you move into Old Testament law, you begin to see that some of the people that it treasures are the weakest people, the widows, the orphans, and the aliens. Now, I'm going to keep moving quickly here. What are the two challenges if you're an immigrant in the Old Testament? Well, they're these. See, in the ancient world, you didn't have a welfare system. Some of that stuff was taken care of at sanctuaries and temples where they would gather food and help the poor. But basically, welfare was handled by the extended family. It was primarily an agrarian peasant culture, and people primarily lived in villages, and so you would be around extended family. And so if you were hurt, or if you were sick, or somebody died, you see, you would have extended family to kind of come around and help. What's the problem if you're a foreigner? No extended family. The other thing is, being a farming community, you needed land. But in the Old Testament, land would go through the male heir. The problem if you're a foreigner is you're not part of the system. So those are the two challenges. This is why you're so vulnerable. You need the Israelites for protection and provision and help and work. And we kind of skim by these things and don't even recognize it. I mean, like you get to the Sabbath law, And it talks about, you know, 6 days you'll work and the seventh day you will rest, and you and your wife and your children and your animals and the alien in your midst. Day laborers. That's what they were. It's like going to the Home Depot and seeing Hispanics standing at the corner. Jesus picks up on this, doesn't he? Legal provision. So if you go into the law, there's laws about food. Here's an interesting one. I just gave you the Sabbath law. You will let them rest. What happens if you're an immigrant? Man, you'll work 24/7. I mean, you'll even work two jobs. And you know what? They'll treat you like that. I know about here in Waco, but in Denver, if you've got construction going on and it's a Sunday and people are working, putting on a roof, I can guarantee you they're Hispanics. You see, because if you don't want to work today, you know what? There's a whole line of people. So if you don't want to work, that's fine. And so they'll work them 24/7. So the law says, no, what? You'll give them rest. You see, the law recognizes human sin and how we take advantage of people. It also says this, interesting if you know any kind of immigrant stories, you will pay them a fair wage. Why do people hire immigrants? They're cheap. You will pay them a fair wage, and you will pay them on time. That's what immigrants don't get. Either a fair wage, oftentimes, being paid on time or being paid at all. Why do this in the law? Why should Israel do this? Well, there's two motivations. One is history. Don't you ever forget where you came from? Don't you remember Egypt and how they treated us? Yeah, step back for a second. Exodus chapter 1. See, what scared the Egyptians? The numbers. They hit a numerical threshold, and that's when they begin to get scared. And so their draconian method was, well, let's kill off the little boys. But they keep them working. So they wanted Israelite labor. They just didn't want the Israelites. Kind of echoes across time. We want their labor. We just don't want them. And God says, you know what? That's how they treated you. Don't ever forget that. And part of our problem in this country, we have historical amnesia. You see, so what we remember, usually like recipes. You know, we've had this Austrian strudel recipe in the family for generations. Really? Yes, it's a secret. I can't tell you what it is because we are Austrian. Really? Do you speak German? No, but we're Austrian. Have you ever been there? No, but, you know, we trace our roots. We do the genealogy thing online, and we know that we have Austrian. Probably goes back to the royal house of Habsburg, you know, but... We have a family friend. Oh, well, we're Italian. Really? You speak Italian? No, but I took lessons once. Really? Have you been there? Yeah, we went for 2 weeks once. So how do you do the Italian thing? Well, we have lasagna for Christmas. But you see, we've reduced the memory to food. That's our memory. Amnesia. So we have St. Patrick's Day for the Irish, and Oktoberfest for the Germans, and Columbus Day for the Italians. Just memories and parades and green beer. The thing that we forgot was the abuse and the hard work and exploitation of our ancestors. And all we remember is the food. And there's so many stories. African Americans, that's an immigrant story. Why were they brought here? Labor. And what was the one thing we didn't want? Their integration. And so we go to Civil War, 13th, 14th Amendment. We wanted their labor. We just didn't want them. An immigrant story. I'm going to move very quickly because my time is... How much time I've got? Okay.
I'll slow down.
New Testament as well. I've kind of gone warp speed to the Old Testament, but you're beginning to see there's just all this information. And then you get to the New Testament, and Jesus began his life as a refugee, for goodness sakes. He and his family have to leave because Herod wants to kill all the little boys, and so that they run off to Egypt. Have you ever thought when they came back to Nazareth, I mean, did Jesus learn Hebrew in Egypt? I mean, did Jesus have like an Egyptian accent? And so when he's playing with the little guys around, well, where's that guy from? Good night. He doesn't pronounce the words right. He's got kind of a funny accent. How about Mary? Did she pick up some like Egyptian recipes, you know, that she would kind of roll out for birthdays or something? I mean, I don't know. But he began his life as a refugee. And then you watch how he treats people that no one else wants to deal with. Prime example of the Samaritans. That's interesting. The woman at the well is a Samaritan woman. So what's a rabbi talking to a woman, let alone a Samaritan woman? And, you know, the Samaritans were despised and half-breeds. And so when Jesus wants to give the example of who to follow in terms of how to treat somebody, he gives them the parable of the good Samaritan. I'm sure that went over real well. You see, we pass over that. Maybe today would be the parable of the good Mexican, or the parable of the good Somali, or the parable of the good Palestinian. You see how Jesus just turns it all upside down, doesn't he? We're all sojourners. You would know this from the New Testament and the call to hospitality. And this goes all the way back to the Old Testament. You see Abraham at this point, in Genesis 18, receiving visitors whom he doesn't know. All the way through the New Testament, of course, we sometimes entertain angels unaware. And hospitality becomes one of the requirements to be a leader in the church, an elder. That'd be interesting if you're having a meeting and someone is, you know, going to be an elder or a pastor. Really, how hospitable are you to outsiders? I mean, that is one of the requirements that Paul has here. Romans 12 and 13. Now I come back full circle, and I'll close with this. You see, we shouldn't even begin in Romans 13 for the very reasons I've told you. And as you see, all the previous revelation of Scripture should inform how we do our laws and the kinds of laws that we want to have in this country. But you see, you come at it very differently now. But you see, even there we should begin reading in Romans chapter 12. You see, Romans 1 to 11 is this grand plan of salvation, and end of chapter 11 is this grand doxology. And then in chapter 12 he says, now look, don't be conformed to the world. Don't let them kind of squeeze you into their mold, you know, the passage. And we usually think of that as materialism and the rampant sexuality or whatever in this culture, and those are good applications. But you know, none of that is mentioned really in that chapter. It talks about how you treat other people. As far as it is possible with you, live at peace with all people. And it tells you about your spiritual gifts and how you're supposed to use them for other people. And then you get to the very end of the chapter, and it says this. How's this for countercultural? He says, look, if your enemy is hungry, you feed him. If your enemy is thirsty, you give him something to drink. And then he moves into chapter 13, talks about the government. You see, that's the government. We're in chapter 12. And I would say this. Even if you have an issue with immigrants, and it's all very kind of natural, there's all kinds of questions, and it's all complicated, this isn't a bullet point conversation. Let me give you a hard word. Even if they're your enemy, you feed them.
even if you think of them as your enemy, you give them water to drink. Don't be molded by the world and how they treat other people. The government does what it does in Romans 13. We're in chapter 12. All kinds of things, and I've just kind of scratched the surface. God cares for the vulnerable. If I were to ask any one of you to give me your Christian testimony, you would tell me a story of tragedy, probably. Somebody died, or you were sick, or there was a moment in your life where you were brought to your knees before God. And usually that emotional humiliation is what drives us to God. And that vulnerability, that moment, is what made us reach out to him. But what you see in Scripture is there's also socioeconomic and political vulnerability. And that's why God cares for the poor and the widows and the orphans.